Like to thank or introduce our speaker for tonight, all the way from Sierra Madre, Sean.
Okay. Oh my, there's lots of devices up here, so I'm going to put this one back. I'm Sean. And I first want to welcome all of you and say thank you for your presence in all of the Al-Anon meetings I've been to and what you do for all the other people who show up in those meetings. And I want to thank Sonny for inviting me here. Thank you, Sonny. It gives me an opportunity to look at my program in a fresh way and revisit some of those things. Some things I don't want to revisit, but it is an opportunity to reflect on what got me here and why I stay here. And congratulations to the newcomers for making it here today. You know, you will find there are answers in this program, but the questions may change. So I hope you can hear me okay. Is that all right? All right, good. You know, the question that I keep coming back to is, why am I here? It's a healthy thing to ask now and then. I used to ask it with ego, why am I here? And sometimes with judgment, why am I here? You know, and but it is a healthy thing for me to keep asking what brings me back. And what brings me back is what I get from the fellowship in this program that I have not found anywhere else in my life. And I've been in a lot of therapy sessions and other things, family therapy, a lot of others, places where the phenomena that happens in this room just doesn't happen there. I think it's something about the honesty and maybe the pain a little bit that softens us up and allows us to share that way, the way we do in this program. Before I go too far, confession. I've had a lifelong struggle with something that is cunning, powerful, and baffling. It's this thing between my ears. Okay, and we may have that in common in Al-Anon with people that are in AA also. It all starts up here. I may not have the allergy of the body, but I have the thinking that will make me do crazy things. You know, I've learned to manage this somewhat. Every now and then I get surprised. I was reading the Science News recently that all of us have apparently 2% Neanderthal DNA. I was sharing with my wife, I had 2% Neanderthal DNA, and she wasn't as surprised as I thought she should be. She thought maybe the percentage was higher for some people. Now I get it, it's a amino-like. I have found ways to explore that uncharted territory in this program, and that's one of the things that has helped me stay sane, is the guidance of this program that allowed me to get through some very tough emotional issues, and thank you all for being here for that, too. I think I'll probably start where this disease came into my life. And I'm going to share a perspective that I have with this disease, which is as a parent. A lot of people I know grew up with this disease. They have a different perspective. All I can do is share you know, what I learned in that experience. And it started a number of years ago. We have three children, beautiful, talented, loving children, and at times two of them who are afflicted by this disease have appeared to me as monsters, ugly, frightening, shape-shifting monsters, and I still love them dearly. That's what the disease did to me in my perceptions of who they were. I didn't understand a lot at that time early in the program how to separate the person from the disease. So it was just all one entity to me. This was kind of a slow burn, I think, in terms of how the disease affected our family. There were behaviors in the teenage years, which initially I just thought, okay, this is kind of stuff I was doing at that age, and didn't think too much about it, but then it became more bizarre and exaggerated, and grades are falling, and the sports interests have gone away, and the people they're hanging out with aren't the right people, and all of these concerns came up. And so we kind of worked through psychologists and other things trying to seek help, and then eventually it became apparent that there was drugs and alcohol behind a lot of this behavior. So after a lot of attempts to solve it in other ways, we decided we're going to have an intervention. And we found this person who was recommended, who worked with young people, and she met with us, kind of explained, that was probably the beginning of my education about this disease. And then she met with both of our sons, and she came back and she said, well, they're using 2 to 3 times a week. I said, oh, that's not so bad. And she said, no, these are addicts. You multiply by 3, okay? Which means they're using every day. And so anyway, that caused enough concern for me that we did actually proceed with this intervention. And leading up to this, there was just a lot of tension in the house. I think that's why I call it a slow burn. It was very progressive, things that used to be very relaxed and natural now were like forced, and so the psychological environment just seemed to get more and more tense. And I think, my first introduction was during that intervention. So we had this intervention, my mother-in-law came, my brother-in-law, who's here tonight, came, and there was a lot of family support. The two alcoholics did not show up. Didn't you know it? So I said, okay, all done here. The problem people aren't here. And she said, oh, no, not so fast. There's work to do here. So we spent 2 days kind of exploring and talking about our feelings and what this meant. And, as I go through this, I'm going to try to separate some facts and then describe some feelings. And I think the reality is sort of in the middle, in my experience. So what it felt like to me is, my son was being consumed from the inside out by this monster, that I viewed. And at some point in the intervention, this person we were working with, Christy, said, well, what do you want to get from this? What's the outcome of this event? And I choked out, I just want my sons back, I just want them back. But I knew in my heart, the people I knew, those, the boys, were not coming back. It was going to be, if they came back, somebody different. So a big part of this program for me early on was just dealing with the loss, the loss of relationships, the loss of things, probably more so the projected losses, because when I was working through I was working through my inventory, I realized that a lot of what held me back in this program were my fears, and one of the big fears was that, my son was going to die, and I had to admit that that's a distinct possibility, and the track he was on, that could happen, but that scared me to death, and that kept me doing crazy things in this program to try to prevent that from happening. So anyway, after that intervention, the situation, of course, didn't improve with them. I had maybe a little better way of thinking of things, but I had a lot of work to do. Somewhere during that process, our interventionist mentioned there's this program called Al-Anon. Okay, yep, got it. And then It was sometime later, almost, I think about a year later, my youngest son plowed his car into a cement wall with three friends in the car. There were injuries. I mean, everybody was injured, some more seriously than others, but thank goodness they all lived. So that started another set of circumstances to deal with. Let me step up. There was an event that happened before that. During my older son, we kind of managed, and he went to college for a bit, but then he couldn't stay sober, and he came home. A lot of issues around that. We asked him to leave, change the locks, and then became a campaign to rescue my younger son. So our interventionist had recommended he go to a treatment program, an inpatient. So, they have these deals where the people come in the middle of the night and take him away. And I decided I couldn't allow that to happen, so I was going to do that myself. So one morning, unbeknownst to him, I had his bags packed in the trunk, and I decided, this was my job. So I was going to take him to school. He caught on when the car went in the opposite direction in the freeway, and I will never forget that, because then the monster was enraged, and his body was flailing around the car. He was smashing the dash. He was in my face, and all I could do was just hold on to the steering wheel, get in the fast lane, just keep going, and I look over, and the car door is open, and the monster's threatening to throw his body into the freeway, and I just keep holding on. Eventually, he did slump back into exhaustion, but I remember just repeating a prayer. I hope my son is still in there and doesn't want to die. But that's the kind of fear that I was experiencing. You probably have all felt similar situations and the emotion that came out of that. But I was thinking back on this. The best I could do at that point was hold on. I didn't know any better on what to do other than try to do what I thought I was supposed to do and just hold on, because I didn't know what was coming at me. And to have some trust that, this wasn't a permanent situation. Something is going to happen to change it. So anyway, he did do that stint. 8 weeks, my wife and I drove the 700 miles round trip to visit him. And that actually turned out to be kind of a therapeutic thing, because we had a lot of hours in the car to talk about what this meant to us, this disease. We attended family therapy. Learned a lot about the disease in that event. I'm pretty sure the counselor mentioned this program called Al-Anon, but I just didn't have time for it at that point. So I kept fighting, and then when the car accident happened about a year after that, and he was 18 by just a few weeks when that happened. Did have a compassionate lawyer who was a recovering alcoholic, and that guy understood what was going on, provided a lot of advice. I think he mentioned a program called Al-Anon too. he helped us through that process. But eventually, my son violated probation, and I was in the courtroom, and they put the cuffs on him, and you're going off to jail. That was like a step one moment for me. That was a surrender. I'd done everything I could to prevent that from happening, and it happened. And that was powerlessness. Now, ironically, this thing I was trying to prevent from happening was the beginning of his recovery. That's exactly what he needed to happen. that was educational. You know, I've since learned anytime we deny somebody the consequences of their actions, the natural consequences of their action, we're doing a disrespect. Now, it's a very difficult situation to determine the boundaries in that when you're a parent, especially if you have an adolescent. You have an obligation to, you know, when they're underage, to keep them from doing harm to other people or themselves. So often I had to figure out, okay, is this enabling or is this, you know, is this something that I should do, you know, because he can't do it for himself. A lot of questions about that. My wife and I had many discussions trying to get on the same page about that. So for the people that are in that situation right now, you know, my advice, give it your best shot. That's all I was doing. I was guessing, you know. With help of this program, I started to get introduced to some people that were around the program, and I got some ideas that there might be help here. Now, what pushed me over the edge was a little later, my daughter, the third child, which you haven't heard mentioned so far, which happens to the kids that are doing what they're supposed to be doing, I guess. Sometimes in these situations, they get lost. But she did say, one day, I've got to do a presentation for this high school class about something really personal, and I want to run it by you because I'm going to talk about my brother's addiction and alcoholism, and she did say some very she shared a lot of insightful things. The thing that stuck in my heart, though, is what she was talking about mostly was things like her mother couldn't get out of bed. She was still so depressed. Her father was, you know, walking around with this cloud over his head, and you know, I was no fun to be around. You know, and I was doing what I thought was, you know, the tough love thing, but there was collateral damage, you know, to her. So she opened my eyes to a fact that, you know, I was stuck in this disease doing everything I could to fix a situation that was powerless, beyond my control, and there were people being neglected, and I was abdicating my responsibility as a father to her. So that pushed me over the edge, and I started going to this Al-Anon program. And my wife and I went to a program called Parents Letting Go in Santa Clara, California. I've only been in the Southland here for about a year. But that's where we started. I was in there with a lot of judgment, you know, parents letting go. I said, it looks like a lot of parents holding on to me. You know, it was like, maybe parents unraveling, you know, was a better term. You know, I was suspicious of this program, especially when, you know, I saw the mentions of God in the steps. There's eight of them to save the newcomer's time. That was an obstacle for me to get over in this program. And that higher power step, I'll talk about it in a minute. My timer went away, so if anybody can refresh this side. Nope, can't see it. Anyway, I have learned since that those people, I've had to admit that those people were a lot like me. They were suffering in the same way I was. And then I heard a little bit of wisdom too. That kept me coming back. There was some wisdom there that, oh, you know, I can actually let go of them. And so anyway, that started the process for me. I did find a home group in a basement, St. Luke's in Los Gatos, California, and it was where I found a sponsor and started working this program. And the sponsor was very gentle. He had a very simple approach. Whatever I was whining about, he would go, just point. Okay, and he would keep pointing that there's this blueprint for something we call recovery in this program, and you ready to get started? And we did. Now those steps were difficult, but boy, am I glad I took them. Along the way, I discovered that fact that, you know, my son is not the disease. He has a disease, and the person that I know and love is still there somewhere. And that was enough to allow me to start to establish some sort of relationship with him. Before, it was like detachment with an axe. You know, I couldn't be around him. It was too difficult. I learned about boundaries. I remember we made a date to go to a movie, and he got in the car, and I could smell, you know. I said, sorry, turn around, I can't do this. And that was respect for myself, that I don't need to allow that stress and the all the things that it brings up in my life. Had to practice that a lot to be able to do that. The other thing I learned about, which I heard from many people tonight, is choices. You know, when I'm down in the trenches in this disease, I have this kind of tunnel vision, and I can't see the choices. You know, I'm operating from the fear zone. I've got two choices: fight or flight. You know, it's the amygdala is what's driving me, and I had to get out of that, and I had to learn ways to take a pause and just say, you know, you have choices. You have a choice here about how you're going to do this. You know, you can bite their head off, or, you know, you can see that there's somebody here who's suffering with a problem, and it's not about you. So along this way, I built what I call my refuge. That's my name for this program of Al-Anon. And that refuge is built on this foundation of the 12 steps of this program. Those are the principles that I choose to live by. Working through those steps, I was freed from a lot of things. One of the things I learned in step one is, you know, I didn't cause it. I can't cure it. I can't control it. And that was liberating, because this was no longer my job to solve this problem. And I was willing at that point to turn over, you know, the natural consequences to the person that owned them. And that was really important. And step two, returning to sanity. Again, that God problem came up. But for me, I was able to, with the help of my sponsor too, see that it says a power greater than ourselves. I had to change that to a power greater than self. Just to remind myself, it's not about me. I've got to find a way somehow to connect with this higher power that has the control over all these events that I don't have the control over. And for me, that was enough to get started. And then I actually, my higher power evolved in this time. It wasn't like a light bulb for me. It actually had to evolve. The group was a power for a long time. The third step, you know, made a decision. Interesting to see, once I looked at it, all the different ways, it was like a tug of war in all directions. And the struggle that I was creating for myself on many fronts, not just with this disease, but, you know, in it was all willfulness, trying to get what I wanted, a lot of the ego, a lot of fear, though, if I was really honest about it. And that became, in the fourth step, an exercise to be really honest about things I hadn't been before. There was a lot of fear behind that. Too many decisions based on fear. So right now, that's a red flag. If I'm making a decision because of the fear I have around it, that's usually the wrong choice. And one of the things that you gave me in this program is the courage to be able to walk through those fears, talk about them, even in a meeting, come out about things that I would never have shared with another human being before this. And there's liberation in that too, and healing that happens. So after the fourth step, you know, it was all about this question of character defects, and I struggle. What is a character defect? You know, is there something wrong with me? You know, And what I settle on is if I'm not doing harm to someone else or myself, then it's just personality. Okay, it's my personality. So crazy at times, but that's what you get. And if I'm not hurting anybody, then it's not a character defect. I had to learn a lot of forgiveness about that because I was putting everything on the character defects list. You know, my sponsor probably rolled his eyes when he saw all of these problems I had. But, you know, part of it is we look at what the consequences of our actions are, the harms, the resentments we're holding on to. And when I started unpacking that with my sponsor in the fifth step, it was like my metaphor is this 1,000-pound backpack that I've been carrying around. And then once I put it down, start pulling out all these rocks that are in it. You know, there's this expectation, these resentments and all of that. And my posture is a lot better these days, you know, that I'm not carrying those things around. And certainly my mental health. There's a little measurement I call the QOB, quality of being. And if I'm good, doing good on that meter, you know, I'm able to love and be able to do all the things that I hope to do, that I aspire to do as a person, as, instead of what I was doing before. So this refuge is now where I go with my problems. And it's up on a mountain, you know. I have a great view. I can see the big picture as opposed to being down in that trench or the rut that I spend so much time in. And I'm going to steal from somebody I heard the other night said their rut became so comfortable they had moved in furniture. And I don't know who said that. I'd like to give them credit. But that stuck in here. That's a beautiful thing because I could certainly relate to it. So based upon that, based upon those principles, I'm not going through all the steps, but when I got to step 10, I had to figure out, okay, taking personal inventory, how do I do that? And over the years, I found for me, it's just having a discipline to sit down and put the time into my life to reflect on a daily basis. What am I doing right? And, you know, how does it feel? You know, what's going on with me? And to look at my intentions, because I realized there were a lot of things, I had hung my hat on a lot of external things, people, places, and things that really weren't delivering for me. There wasn't a lot of satisfaction. There was a lot of disappointment in that. And that's the shift that happened naturally in this program, to look at the internal things, the important things, what we call the spiritual side of this program, and to work on that ability, that capacity for compassion, and the ability to overcome the fear by understanding. You know, that's what I found is the antidote for me. I have to go face the fear, look at it, see in whatever way I can, you know, what's behind that. One of the other fears is despair, you know, was learning how to be loving in a different way, especially in these relationships with the people we call our qualifiers. And it was a practice to practice these intentions. And one of the things I have realized is if I can remain conscious of what I really want to do most of the time, it does happen that way. Or if it doesn't happen that way, I'm okay with it. You know, I can roll with it. So there was another area where I had to figure out how do I sustain this. And there are things. There's a little slogan. 25 after. Okay. There's a slogan in the books about awareness, acceptance, and action, okay? And I took that lightly when I was introduced to it, and then I realized for me, that is the practice. That's what I have to do every day. I somewhere along the line, it's not conference approved, but I noticed in emotional intelligence literature, they call this reflection and acceptance. and integrity. And there are these parallels on there, and they call that the three characteristics of self-regulation. I said, hey, this is a lot like the Al-Anon statement, exactly, as it turned out. So how do I do that? Well, the awareness part is really, again, a daily practice. I was introduced to meditation in this program, and that is one of the tools that I use. I did that even before I got to step 11, just because I needed to learn how to be okay with my own thinking. Remember the 2% plus Neanderthal up here that sometimes just wants what it wants, and it wants it now. And I can go there if I'm not, building the strength. The way to do that is, I have a 10-second personal inventory. How am I feeling in my body? Am I tense right now? What's happening with me physically? And then the emotions, and then last the thoughts, because the thoughts are the ones I can't trust, you know. But I can recognize and know that this is what's happening for me right now. And it seems really simple, but I never did that in all my years before this program. I never checked in with myself to say, how are you doing? You know, what's going on? So that's the awareness and making the time to do that. The acceptance is being okay with uncertainty, being okay with change, especially the ones I don't have control over. And, from that, in working on that side of it, I realized I've got a lot of filters and biases and stuff that are going on in there. And when I can kind of push that aside, the benefit is clarity to see what's true, what's the reality of a situation. That's the acceptance for me is clarity. To be able to actually go up there without all this baggage, with all this other stuff layered on top that I used to carry around. The action part, learned in working these steps that my words are often used as weapons. If you're familiar with the root of sarcasm, it means to tear flesh. And that was a tool I knew well. I've tried really hard to put that out of my vocabulary, or maybe the word not out, but to practice. Learn how, and this all came from this program, believe it or not, how to honestly and clearly communicate what's going on with me to another human being. I practice that with my sponsor. I practice that in these meetings every week. I get inspired by other people doing that. And it gave me the courage to learn how to do it. And I think, there isn't anything. There are things I have shared in this room that I have not shared with family members or anybody else. Because this is okay. This is a safe place to do that. And I learned how to do that with people around me in time, with my wife and family members. I learned it from the amends, too. And a lot of healing came out of those amends, the things I didn't want to do. A lot of healing came from that. The other thing I had to learn how to do is say no when I have a strong compulsion to say yes. And to shut up. I take that time, when I have this compulsion to like insert my opinion or something, and I have an abundance of opinions, to say what I'm going to say, is this truthful, is it useful? I call it TUTS, my acronym. Is it truthful, is it useful, and is it timely? If it isn't, shut up. Serves no purpose. And funny thing is, you can actually listen to what people are saying, and they will tell you things, and they will give you understanding. So those are the kind of pillars of how I practice it. And practice the program, that's what I do every day. This is my experience, my perspective. I hope some of that may be useful to you, or you're probably doing it already. You teach me so much every week on how to live life. And I think, you know, the payoff for me is some well-being. That I didn't come into this program for that reason, certainly. I came in here to fix these people that were problems. And, you know, maybe it was a good thing that people with the problems didn't show up, because I was the beginning of looking at myself, you know, who was the bigger problem in this whole scenario. So anyway, it's close to wrapping up time, but I wanted to say one final thing is, especially to the newcomers, that it is possible with the help of this program for you to turn or to have your anger displaced by compassion, to have your fear, you know, dissolved by understanding, and to have the despair lifted by love. And I think if you can do that, it's even possible to embrace the monster and love it to death. So anyway, thank you for listening to me.